What is it that either incentivizes someone to not see the humanity in another human being or incentivizes them to see the humanity in another human being that they've never met and have no reason to care about? That is fascinating.
In 2015, after spending 4 years in an Italian prison for a murder she didn't commit, the 25-year-old Amanda Knox was exonerated and walked free. But in the eyes of the public, she was still guilty, or in the very least, had no business speaking out about the injustices committed against her. I'm almost the exact same age as Amanda, and this is one of the biggest international stories of my early 20s. What's up, guys? I'm John Roa, and welcome back to Between Us, where I get to have raw, vulnerable conversations with some of the world's most successful people. The term success today has a lot of connotations. It's usually financial or business or fame. I prefer to give it a wider definition: overcoming tremendous adversity and achieving something that very few have. Under that definition, my guest today is one of the most successful people I've ever spoken to. She's had to battle for her very livelihood, her freedom, her humanity, and her future. And she won. And afterwards, she had to consider how that journey, which had unfortunately defined her life, will create opportunity and purpose in her future, not just tarnish it. On today's show, Amanda Knox opens up about how being wrongfully convicted affected everything from her personal life to her mental health, and how it's inspired her to share stories similar to her own. She talks about how even after she was free, her parents warned her that there'd be no going back to the life that she used to have, how for the rest of her life, she'd be judged and hunted. So how is one supposed to prioritize their own mental health after something so traumatic? What incentivizes us to ignore the humanity in somebody else? And what systems are in place that can sway the court of public opinion so strongly in false directions? Amanda discusses with me how these questions and more led her to writing her memoir, Waiting to be Heard, and how judgment is inherently human, but that the truth matters. She talks about how even after her acquittal and exoneration, in the eyes of the public and even herself, she was still somehow guilty. We examine how algorithms and echo chambers help shaping media narratives, what role Amanda believes that feminism played in her conviction, and how class and social background ultimately come to define how we view crime and punishment. What solutions may lie in shifting our perspective around the accused? Maybe in pulling away from the siren song of social media, we can change our criminal justice system as well. I'm really excited for you guys to hear this fascinating conversation about forgiveness, overcoming trauma, and how to use hardships to help others. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Amanda Knox. How are you?
Good. Let's see. I mean, just in general, getting a lot of work done and staying inside, staying isolated, feeling that cabin fever, just like everyone else.
Yeah.
But understanding that, you know, just because you feel cabin fever doesn't mean that you should act upon it.
I know. It's crazy because you guys kind of got hit somewhat first, right, with COVID. It kind of popped up in the Pacific Northwest. And then we got completely slammed, and New York was ground zero for, you know, whatever, 2.5-3 months. And it's since been much better here. And people have been, you know, following the rules, but also getting back to some normalcy. We've opened up our restaurants and stuff like that. But I know the West Coast has kind of come and gone a lot more than us. And so it's got to be even more difficult dealing with it when it's kind of seems to be improving, then you're back to, you know, being locked up and then back and forth, back and forth, back and forth.
Yeah. And I think, you know, so the back and forth doesn't help. This current smoke situation, I guess, helps in the sense that it's just one more reason to stay quarantined.
Yeah.
But it's, I think another thing, I actually had a conversation with this with a friend of mine here in Seattle, because there happened to have been this like big rally that took place in one of the big neighborhoods in Seattle, where people weren't wearing masks. And it was a Christian celebration. So they were trying to like, they were trying to inspire hope in people and all of that, but doing so from what I consider, you know, a very hypocritical stance that like, if you're praying, you're fine,
right.
Which is not true.
Right.
Anyway, so I was talking to a friend of mine and we were discussing how another thing that's been really tough is how there has been a lot of inconsistent messaging about the pandemic, about mask use, about the risks, even. And a lot of that is because a lot of information is coming our way from people who are incentivized one way or another to either catastrophize or to underplay. I think that it's frustrating, and I understand why people get frustrated, because, you know, there's not a sense of unity of understanding about what the numbers mean, what the testing means. And also, I think our leaders would really benefit from some humility by saying, like, you know, we don't know always what the best thing to do is, but we're doing what we think is the best thing. And we ask that everyone come together on this, because no effort is going to be effective if no one tries it.
Of course.
I don't know. It's,
I mean, the humility and candor amongst leadership is something we've obviously been grossly lacking. And in the countries that haven't grossly lacked it, you're seeing a lot of improvements and a lot of you know, combined efforts forward, and the economy's coming back quicker, people getting back to their normal lives. And it's depressing what's happening on this side. And, you know, it's interesting to have visibility. I have friends in different places around the world, and to hear how effectively they've come back to at least some levels of normalcy, you know, be it family oriented or economic or whatever their benchmark is, when we are still just seemingly regressing on a day-to-day basis from a leadership perspective. And it's tough. It's tough to deal with.
Yeah.
During the pandemic, I was here in Manhattan completely alone for about 3.5 months. And, you know, you could walk New York and not see a human being. And it was like the I Am Legend kind of vibe. You're like looking down Broadway without seeing a human being. It's an interesting phenomenon. Great to meet you officially. I know we talked on the phone, but it's great to connect. And very thankful for Carrie for doing so. You know, I've been listening to a lot of the content you're doing with Carrie on the podcast, and I think it's fantastic.
Thank
you. Yeah. You know, I'm so engrossed and fascinated in your story and in the wisdom that you're able to convey, you know, based on this hell of an experience that you've had. What I want to start with is kind of to bring the listeners up to speed a little bit. I think most people can relate to the story we heard from 2007 to 2011. I don't know how you would have missed it. But after that, so 2011, you are finally acquitted. You return to the Seattle area. And I'm guessing you had a lot of decisions to make on what your life was going to be next. And I'd like to hear a little bit about the next number of years that brought you to writing your memoir, what that experience was like, and just to kind of catch us up so when we can get into now what you're doing, your activism, your writing, your podcast, et cetera.
Absolutely. And I think this... it's been a very fascinating journey to be on these past, I guess it would be almost 10 years now since I got out. So much growth has, and so much learning and understanding and processing in the past almost decade. When I first got out of prison, I understood that I had yet another mountain to climb coming back into the world. Because suddenly I was Foxy Noxy, and, you know, that didn't go away with my acquittal. I knew, because people told me, that I was going to be publicly scrutinized, but I didn't really fully comprehend what that was going to be like. I was being scrutinized in the courtroom, and, you know, throughout my prison experience, I was always the American, the famous one. I had to deal with that experience within the prison environment, but dealing with that experience within the broader world of freedom was a whole different animal altogether. Rebuilding my life, I knew that there was one really important aspect that needed to happen, and that was I needed to tell my side of the story.
Yeah.
So I felt that there was a chorus of voices of people authoring my experience and saying not only what happened to me, but also what kind of person I was, what I must have felt, what must I said. And I thought that I needed to sort of set the record straight as far as where I stood on what had happened to me and what I thought about what had happened to me.
Really quick. So you mentioned that people were kind of preparing you for this journey. Who was that? And what were you being told was going to happen to you once you're going to return to your what was your normal life at one point?
Yeah. So it was mostly my family. Yeah. They had lived through the nightmare of 4 years having to not only be my support system, but also to be the public face of my defense.
Yeah.
It was my family, my mom, my dad, my sisters, my best friends, who were basically my proxy to the outside broader world.
Right.
And they did an incredible job dealing with an incredibly stressful, high stakes job of being my voice, basically. And my parents told me that we were going to have to deal with being chased down and no privacy. And I had to, you know, I couldn't trust anyone. And that was hard for me to hear,
right,
to very honestly, because the last thing that I wanted going into freedom was another kind of prison,
right,
where the prison was not that human beings were placing bars around me, but that I just couldn't trust other human beings.
Sure.
That was really hard for me.
And did that happen? Were there examples where that was quickly proven to be true? You know, kind of once you were back with that lack of trust that you shouldn't have in people?
Yes. In almost every way that my privacy and humanity could be violated, it was. So just to give a few examples, like, you know, famously, there is the moment of me coming out of prison. What needed to happen to make that possible was a local politician had to pull a bunch of strings in order for me to be loaded into a car that was within the prison grounds. So I didn't just walk out of the prison grounds unprotected into a throng of people, because there was a throng of people and reporters outside the prison gates ready to basically fall upon me. I was given that grace of being put into a car first. And what followed was a high-speed chase into the night where my stepdad was in another car following mine. He was being rammed by paparazzi behind us. Going into the airport, it was, you know, again, so blessed to have someone who worked for the airline that I was going to be going home on, going out of their way, reaching out to my family, saying, how can I help?
Wow.
And they were able to facilitate security from the airport to escort me through so that I wouldn't be trying to like show people my passport while being photographed and having questions thrown at me. That whole journey of like trying to get home safely and without harassment involved a lot of extra steps. And only think by the grace of people coming out of the woodwork to offer their help was I able to do that.
Well, there's a dichotomy right there, right? Is because you're seeing the best and worst in real time, in parallel, probably all the time. And you're probably as taken by the generosity and the goodwill of certain people as you are the ill will of others, all at the exact same time. And is that a kind of recipe or a dynamic that's continuing in your life even today?
I would say yes. And I think that honestly, you know, it sounds very extreme,
right,
what happened to me in my case, where, you know, people were doing everything they possibly could to just get the first picture of me,
right,
and doing so in a way that was increasingly like incredibly invasive and very much a harassment, not thinking about my own well-being and my own humanity in the process of doing that. And other people who were very much going out of their way to think, oh my gosh, what is it going to be like for this girl to try to get through the airport knowing that this is going to happen? What can I do to help?
Like, right.
So there's this really interesting moment of either being utterly dehumanized or being totally humanized,
right,
despite, you know, the broader conception of me, which was this like idea of Foxy Noxy, whatever. I do think that it's tempting to think that this only happens in extreme situations, but honestly, what I found is that increasingly our culture is such that we're constantly all doing that to each other.
Right.
And yeah. I'm clearly very sensitive to it because it happened to me in a very extreme way. I feel like I have a sort of radar for it, and mm-hmm. I notice it when other people don't happen to be noticing it. So what's more interesting to me is, what is it that either incentivizes someone to not see the humanity in another human being, or incentivizes them to see the humanity in another human being that they've never met and have no reason to care about? That is fascinating.
As it should be. We reference your memoir. So again, I can't wait to finish it. And it's, you're a fabulous writer, and you have a fabulous way to I guess, humanize your own experience, but also what you've taken from this incredible and insane experience that you've had. And so you mentioned kind of the purpose. So what was your core purpose beyond, you know, above telling your story, which was obviously the quite literal nature of a memoir, but how was that kind of participative in your purpose, and how did that lead into what you're doing now with your work in activism and criminal justice reform?
My memoir was my first step, my first attempt at trying to humanize what I felt was an incredibly dehumanized experience, where I felt like I had lived through something that I didn't feel another human being would ever live through. Mm-hmm. I was shocked to discover the kinds of conditions that a human being can be put through. So I felt like, one, that deserved to go acknowledged. But furthermore, I had noticed throughout my entire, you know, trial process that words were being put into my mouth, yeah. and claims were being made about me that were simply not true. And I felt I was at a place in my life where I felt, you are entirely entitled to judge me, but judge me based on reality. Don't judge me based on your fantasy.
Sure. Right.
So that's what I was attempting to accomplish, was acknowledging, like, okay, judgment is something that is an inherent thing that we are always going to be doing to each other. I am not above being judged, but the truth matters. Right. And so here's the truth.
Right.
That it has evolved over the course of these many years, because I can't say that if I were to write my memoir today, I would write the same memoir. Mm. There are a number of things that I, you know, as a 25-year-old who had just gotten out of prison, I had not fully processed everything that had happened to me. And I continued to blame myself for a lot of the things that happened to me.
Right.
For instance, you know, when trying to understand why the police focused on me, of all people, like, why me? That this has been a question that has plagued me throughout my imprisonment, and honestly plagues me to this day. Like, why
right.
me? And I really felt like it must be something to do with me. Like, did I say something in a weird way? Did I not understand their questions well enough? Did I do something weird? And all of the narratives about my case really reinforced that idea that it was something about me that was wrong.
Right.
And I tried to, in my memoir, to acknowledge how I was different than the people around me, and maybe that was why, but also to sort of clarify that, you know, all of the different ways that all of you say that I'm crazy, that I'm either histrionic or that I'm a sex maniac or whatever, that isn't true. So don't, like, think that that's the answer.
Right.
Over the course of my unofficial scholarship into the how our criminal justice system works and coming into contact with other wrongfully convicted people, I've come to realize that my own wrongful conviction had almost entirely nothing to do with me.
Right.
So I just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah. And you talk a lot about this on the podcast that you do with Carrie and elsewhere. And I found it so interesting with how much, you know, I guess it's not surprising, but the amount of empathy that you can deliver to cases other people might write off or not look as in the same way that you can. And it really sounds like the jumping off point was the memoir to first get your story out there and get the facts out there. And then it allowed you, I'm guessing, to start to reorient how you then take that experience and make it into a new life for yourself. And so what were the turning points after the memoir in the last 7 years that have brought you to your platform today of criminal justice reform, of activism, of storytelling, of this empathetic, you know, kind of retelling of accounts that people might not get otherwise? What were some of the turning points that brought you there?
When I first wrote my memoir, I thought that was going to be it, right? Like I, going through my whole, the whole process that I went through, I felt like something was happening to me. It was not something that I had done or made. It didn't belong to me. So I felt like I need to just tell honestly my experience, and then I can move on and go back to the life that I had before, which was a life that was interested in creative writing and in languages. And so what I immediately did was I went back to school in order to study those things. And there were a number of things that were turning points for me that made me realize that not only was the life that I had before this, that no longer existed, but also that I had an ongoing journey related to the criminal justice system that I did not realize that I had in front of me.
Right.
A major one was, here I was back in poetry class, inadvertently and despite all my best efforts, writing about prison. And I realized that it wasn't just enough to for me to process what happened to me, to just say, here's A to B, what happened, judge for yourselves.
Right.
Because no, I was continuing post my memoir to process all of that pain, all of that loss, all of the meaning behind all of that pain and loss, all of my memories of the other people who were imprisoned and why they were imprisoned, how they interpreted their own, that like the course of their own lives that led them to commit crimes and what their plans were afterwards. And I saw case after case come into the public eye, people at the center of those cases being dehumanized in the exact same way that I was.
Yeah.
And it got to the point where I was like, I feel like no one's saying what needs to be said.
Yeah.
And I guess that's something I can do.
Well, I really was fascinated hearing you and your husband, Christopher, talking about cases like the Central Park Five that have recently been kind of reintroduced to us through dramatic takes of cinema. And just to hear the automatic perspective that you probably have, where you just simply go, nope, that's not right. Nope, they're doing that. And just how instantly you can see it because of a lens that none of us can possibly appreciate. And so when you, I guess that's the open question. When you watch a film or a documentary, are you just kind of picking out what you're just saying, listen, I can automatically tell what's going wrong here and where somebody's being vilified or mischaracterized or where they cut corners or where they're not telling you the truth? Is that how you're automatically viewing the world now?
Yeah, I do feel that I have a deep sensitivity for particularly the narrative representation and the narrative choices that we make to represent certain ideas and certain perspectives about a case.
Yeah.
So like, you know, and there are some very like obvious ones. One is, what story did you even choose to tell? Who did you choose to interview? These are all things that are very telling about what the perspective is meant to be. But there's also, you know, to give an example, there's a documentary about my case, right? It was put onto Netflix.
Yeah.
A lot of people have seen it, and for good reason, because it's a good documentary. I think they did a really good job. The filmmakers, I felt, were very responsible. And the reason why I think they came across as very responsible was because they walked this very fine line between what people perceived to be true, what was true, and how the different people at the center of this perfect storm of mistakes and judicial errors were able to arrive at their particular perspective, how these human beings were incentivized and misunderstood or given more due than they should have been. So I think that, like, for instance, you look at how my prosecutor, Giuliano Magnini, in that documentary, it wasn't just a representation of him railroading an innocent person that he knew to be innocent because he's some like evil guy. That's not who my prosecutor is. And that's not how this happened. And it's not how most wrongful convictions happen. It's because someone is like my prosecutor, is coming from is a human being who has a certain set of prejudices that are not based in malice, but simply based in culture and personal experience. So, you know, culturally, my prosecutor didn't know what to do with me. And he was motivated from the standpoint of, there is a terrible crime against a young girl who reminds me of my own daughter, and I need to win this case because it is unacceptable that this should happen, and her family deserves justice. And he, like all human beings, was incentivized to win, but also was disincentivized from recognizing his own mistakes and acknowledging them. So, I mean, I think that they did a very good job to allow him to present the reasoning behind why he believed the things that he believed, even if he was wrong, and didn't just automatically vilify him by sort of rendering him this like distant, unrelatable monster. Everyone, I feel like, came across as relatable, even when they were despicable. Like if you look at Nick Pisa in that documentary, the journalist, he came across as incredibly despicable, but he was also able to talk about his incentive structure and how the media is, the way that the whole media system works, incentivizes him to make the choices that he makes.
Well, it sounds like you're identifying a nuance and a multiple perspectives of these situations that you weren't given the same thing, that you're identifying exactly how you wish you would have been perceived, that there's a nuance, that there's a spectrum of opinions and motivations and incentives, but none of that was given to you. And is that why you're so kind of empathetic and sensitive towards that now? Because you didn't get it back then?
Absolutely. I mean, basically I'm trying to do the opposite of what happens to me.
Exactly.
And that requires doing one's homework, and that requires not like giving up the opportunity to be a part of the hot take conversation. Yeah. Like I can't tell you the number of times that I have refused opportunities to comment upon things that I didn't know enough about because I felt like it wasn't responsible.
Yeah.
And I always try to approach my subjects with a sense of compassion and caution. So you brought up, you know, the Central Park Five case. One thing that I'm really proud about having done the whole season of the podcast was, one, spent time talking about the experience of these young boys and how they were completely railroaded, young kids. Yep. There was prejudice against them. There was heightened hysteria at the time in New York City, due in part to a legitimate like crime wave that was happening, but that resulted in there being stereotypes and prejudices against young Black men. These young Black men were denied their due rights. They were utterly vilified. They were turned into scapegoats for all of the violent problems that were happening in New York City. At the same time, I tried to acknowledge that Linda Fairstein was, you know, the way that she was portrayed in When They See Us, it was as someone who was flippantly racist and utterly didn't care about these young men.
Yeah.
And I think that that wasn't taking into account her full context. So if we understand the history of gender violence in the United States and how second wave feminism really started identifying law enforcement as the only means to address gender violence in the United States, we can better understand why Linda Fairstein was a part of a movement for gender justice and celebrated as a figure of gender justice, all the while becoming a villain in racial justice without even realizing it. So like these, we need to understand where people's incentive structures are coming from. And unfortunately, you know, like it's fascinating the history of how feminism has led to, has contributed to mass incarceration,
right,
in part because there's been an over-reliance on criminalization to deal with gender violence.
Yeah, which is fascinating as it is concerning that we don't get more of this narrative, right? That this is not your typical narrative and people are still following the salacious kind of low-hanging fruit whenever it comes to these stories. And it takes so much effort to dig through all of that to get to a perspective like you're bringing us. We talked a few weeks ago, and I was really taken by how everything you're doing is in this kind of nuanced gray area of perspective. And you talked about the divisions of our class system in America, for instance, the division between crime victims and crime perpetrators, the infamous, the famous, the celebrities, the celebrated, and all these different pieces. And I want you to talk a bit more about kind of this platform that you're developing and this nuance of perspective you're trying to bring. First of all, how you see it, what you're doing with it, and why we don't see more of it. And then how do we take your point of view and make that more significant? Because we are so ripe for this in this country, especially, and there's not enough voices like yours out there. And why?
Well, gosh, I mean, if I knew the answer to that, I wouldn't have to hustle so hard.
Right.
I mean, so first of all, I have to say that I have to give tremendous props to Carrie Antholis and crimestory.com, because I would not be able to do and to produce the work that I'm producing without his support.
Yeah.
So him giving me a platform, him supporting me to do this work has allowed me to basically do this, which is take all of the things that have troubled me about my own experience and reach out to other human beings who either have direct experience or have studied extensively various aspects of these issues and talk to them and just really get real with people about what is going on. I talked about how feminism has led to mass incarceration. I only learned about that because there is a wonderful professor named Aya Gruber, who I interviewed for crimestory.com, who has done extensive research into the feminism, like since the advent of feminism, and how the different waves of feminism have reacted to or have reacted to gender violence and have tried to find solutions inside and outside the criminal justice system. Mm. You have to actively seek out people who have people and perspectives that are diverse, like that are different than your own, and that may, you know, challenge certain narratives that you're telling yourself.
Yeah.
That is incredibly important. I believe in talking to current and formerly incarcerated people. I believe in talking to prosecutors and law enforcement. I believe in talking to people on the street about their experiences, crime victims. Like, everyone is impacted by the system and everyone has a perspective. And it's worth digging into where people are coming from with their perspective and why.
Right.
You know, so with Carrie Antholis, working on with him and crimestory.com, basically pumping out twice a week in-depth interviews that talk about things as complex as the concept of moral luck and how that plays out in our criminal justice system in terms of both poverty, but also violence. That is like a really complex idea that is almost unapproachable to people that I try my best to make approachable.
Yeah.
And the best way I know how to do that is sort of through channeling it through how I'm processing my own experience directly.
Yeah. I was going to say, it sounds like a parallel journey with what you're learning about yourself, how you're reflecting on this experience you've had in the last 13 years, and then almost instantaneously turning that into content, into perspective, into points of view that we all need to be hearing. And it sounds like it's kind of building in parallel, kind of on top of each other, which has got to be exciting, but it's also got to be one of those things where it seems like the learning must be so like so rapid that it's like on a daily basis, your perspective is changing as you're telling us about the perspective. I mean, it sounds kind of exhausting.
I mean, it's as exhausting as therapy is exhausting.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Like, I don't have to go to therapy because basically this is my therapy.
Totally. Yeah.
And that's good. Like, yeah. You know, and I'm grateful to have the opportunity for my attention to be diverted towards something really productive.
Yeah.
Like allowing my mind to change as information, as I'm given more context and more information.
Yeah.
So, and like, I would love to share that with people. I hope that people are listening and taking in these new ideas and experiences. I'm not sure if people are, because I think that we have moved towards a more, I do believe that we have a problem with echo chambers.
Yes.
I do think we have a problem with people only seeking out perspectives that confirm their own pre-existing beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that I'm setting a good example. I'm doing my best to try to be fair and to give all context to anyone that I'm talking to, even at the expense of popularity, say.
Right.
I don't end up being the symbol of whatever, you know, idea, because I don't perfectly represent every perfectly idea. I'm sort of often building bridges between different ideas that come into conflict with each other, precisely because I see the humanity in many positions. And I don't, you know, that doesn't make you a very good symbol, but honestly, my experience with being a symbol of anything has never been positive.
I was going to say, I mean, I think that this is the exact way that you become an actual symbol of something you believe in, is not to try to subscribe to a certain narrative or a certain caricature, because it hasn't worked, you know, frankly, in the past. And you called yourself a misfit in your email to me, and because you exist in this gray area and you don't totally subscribe to either side of these overly divergent concepts that we kind of get stuck into today. And you mentioned the echo chamber. And for me, what's interesting is I you know, come across endless narratives on things like social media where you just feel like could not be going in a worse direction as a culture, as a society, as people that are supposed to be deep and qualitative thinkers. It seems like it's just going out the window at a rapid pace. Then I talk to people like you and Carrie Antholis and Scott Budnick, who I mentioned to you, who are seemingly stepping up in incredible ways and pushing the opposite narrative of incredibly helpful, constructive, deep, and productive thinking. Well, the other is half the world's going that way. And so it seems like we're running further and further and further away from a middle ground where we can all, I think, just exist in a passively productive and successful way. But it's going to be the efforts of folks like you guys that pushed us towards, hopefully, you know, an overall improvement when things like social media are just so depressing. And I'm imagining that you're finding the same thing on those kind of platforms. And I know you're pretty active and you create your audience, but I'm imagining that it's not the easiest place for you to push these narratives and get this point across.
No, it's not. Honestly, I have a very fraught relationship with social media, precisely because I know how much it played into my own wrongful conviction,
right.
But also because it's currently not a healthy place to exist. Now, if I want to get my work out to the world and share it with people, I'm sort of active in it in as a necessary kind of evil. And also, you know, I try to benefit from the intended benefits of social media, which is sharing and staying in touch, coming across new ideas. Unfortunately, and I just saw this really great documentary called The Social Dilemma, which if you haven't seen, I highly recommend.
I have, yeah.
But yeah, it's almost not entirely our fault that we are addicts to echo chambers, because we're being addicted to bad ideas.
Yes.
Like that's just true. Like we are actively, the way that algorithms work in social media is the only thing that matters is whether or not it gets you to click on something. And if it were, it gets you to look at something for more than two or like a split second.
Yeah.
So if that's the case, then ultimately what rises to the top of people's awareness is the most outrageous and salacious. And that's just an inevitable factor in how these algorithms are programmed.
Yep.
And so it's no wonder that all of us now are at a place where our understanding, like the facts that we have in front of us and the perspectives that we have in front of us, are entirely radically different.
Mm.
And I don't blame people for being confused or addicted to radical perspectives, because that has been, you know, like, we're not entirely at fault for, like, our brains have been tricked. We've right. literally been duped, and our brains have failed us. And it would be good to, first of all, acknowledge that we're not as smart as we think we are, and that we're very easily manipulated.
Say the least, yeah.
And two, that, like, you know, the forces that are pushing different narrative, like, you know, this polarization, interestingly, we're, you know, are not necessarily coming from a evil person in a room manipulating the world kind of way, but simply in a, like, capitalist, like
business,
very
yeah.
basic, like
yeah.
profit business,
yep.
profit at all costs kind of place. So I understand how easy it was to believe the Foxy Noxy narrative, because it was eye-catching, and because it was titillating, and because unraveling that narrative required too much work.
Right.
Like, I get it.
Yeah.
So I don't know, like, because that happened to me, because there was that catalyst in my own life, I now, everything that is of that ilk tastes bitter to me. It has left a bitter taste in my mouth, and I can't easily swallow things that I feel are coming from a place of salaciousness
right.
or outrageousness, or like an us versus them mentality. Like, all of that really strikes me as so obviously wrong that, of course, I couldn't swallow it. But that's not, you know, that's only because of this huge catalyst in my life. How Carrie Anthalis came to that realization, I don't know. I should talk to him about that. Like, right. how do you get to a place where you're not just like, screw those other guys, they're wrong, they're bad. Like, that's the default.
Yeah. And this is what is so impressive, you know, about you, because you really have found a way to find nuance and find varying perspectives for people that you probably should, you don't have an obligation to find that, right? And you've put yourself out there so much to find it. You also have a quote where you said, you're either perpetually disappointed at what's going on, or you're so impressed, you know, with kind of the quality of human beings that are around you. And again, it's that incredible divisiveness you've experienced. That perpetual disappointment, though, is something that I think we've all felt. And in a year like 2020, maybe getting somewhat worse, right? Everything you're saying with that echo chamber and the divisiveness and the social media negative impact on our society is just very apparent these days. How has that affected you and your mental health in the last 13 years? I can imagine your mental health journey has been an extraordinary roller coaster, as much as anything you've experienced. So talk a bit about that and kind of where this divisiveness and as you said, perpetual disappointment has played into that arc and how you've overcome that, because that is an incredible feat in itself.
Actually, that's really, really thoughtful of you to even ask about my mental health. I think that's something that we should all be thinking about more these days. Like, the stresses that this year have placed upon all of us is huge. To even be a part of a conversation these days is so incredibly stressful. It feels like fight or flight at every moment.
Yeah.
That, me personally, I like many people my age, struggle with depression and anxiety. It's not something that, like, people would guess looking at me. Even my own sister, like, I have a younger sister who deals with anxiety and panic attacks. And when I happened to mention that I've dealt with that too, she was like, oh my God, are you kidding me? You're so put together. You get stuff done.
Right. Yeah.
And it's like, well, yes, I'm fortunate that, like, my depression and anxiety is not utterly debilitating, but it is something that I have to work on every single day. And, you know, my husband and I are in the practice of meditating every morning to try to put ourselves in the right mind space, to try to remember that everything that appears to us and that we're experiencing is not something that necessarily defines who we are and what and how we have to exist in the world. So really like having a moment to take a breath and take a step back before immediately reacting to the world around us, that is really important to me, to not be reactive, to be proactive, and to really like keep in mind that the easiest way to dehumanize another human being is to not, when you have a reaction to them, to not take a step back and observe your reaction before acting upon it.
Right.
So that is a really important practice that we have to remind ourselves to put into practice every day. It is something that we actively practice with our work. Something that I is sort of maybe a fault of mine is I work really, really hard on every single article that I write. Mm. I do so much homework. And I, after I like go through an interview, I spend a long time going through the transcript and going, okay, here's what the person said. And here's what another person is going to use as a salacious soundbite.
Right.
But I'm going to find what the person really meant. And a lot of times when we have conversations with people, the conversation is not a statement of how that person, what that person believes. That conversation is an ongoing process of mutual discovery of what we mean. And when I'm talking to someone, I want to give them the chance to work with me to make what their point is clear and what their perspective is clear. So I try really, really, really hard to not just get people to say things to me, but to understand what they are meaning behind what they say and asking questions that get at the heart of what a person means.
Right.
Because, you know, language is different, and within different even communities, one thing like Black Lives Matter is going to mean something very different in another community based upon all the connotations that are involved.
Of course.
So anyway, like,
well, yeah,
I think that's really important.
It's really important. And I appreciate you sharing your perspective on your own mental health. I know it's not easy to talk about. It's a core theme of this podcast. And we have two core themes, mental health and success. And mental health is our core theme because every single person deals with it. And the people that are at a point in their lives or journeys to talk about it, I think are the most powerful people in the world because it's a very difficult topic to talk about. It's one that I've dealt with since I was a child and I had never addressed publicly until I guess a week ago, or I guess this podcast a few months ago, but really a week ago in my memoir where I lay it all out.
Yeah.
And we've talked to so many people who just have these incredible journeys. And on this podcast, we talk a lot about how they've overcome their own minds and their own sometimes debilitating, you know, positions in life to create success. And our traditional definition of success is usually things like wealth or things like status or whatever. But I look at your journey as a level of success that's almost unparalleled because you succeeded in getting back your humanity and your freedom, and which is just a incredible level of success that usurps virtually every person I've ever talked to. And so, but when I think of your journey to success and your own mental health and those battles and how difficult that must have been in the last 13 years, it is hard to even fathom how you've overcome that and how strong you must be as a person. I consider you as successful as they come because of what you've accomplished in your own humanity, in your own life, and your freedom.
Oh.
And sharing your perspective on mental health, I think, is incredibly powerful. And I think a lot of listeners will be very fulfilled to hear that you know, you can talk about what you've experienced from that angle.
You know, you mentioned how my journey has been one of reclaiming my humanity. And that's super true in the sense that, you know, I was accused of one of the most horrific crimes that you possibly can be accused of. And all of the hatred and condemnation and humiliation, all of that came raining down on me. And, you know, to this day, people affirm to me that I have no right to talk about my experience because I'm not the real victim. Mm. I was not the person who was murdered. So therefore, what I've experienced and what I've suffered and what perspective I've gained doesn't matter or is offensive So like I grapple with those kinds of really hateful assertions and dehumanizing assertions every day. At the same time, I have to say that, and maybe you tell me if you had this experience as well, I think the thing that really sort of tests your sanity is when what is reflected in the outside world isn't a reflection of what is inside of you. Mm. And what was weird in my case was, here I was in a prison cell, locked up as a sex maniac, drug addict, murderer, when I'm not, having to go through the day-to-day life of being patted down and not having any privacy and just being perpetually reminded that I am less human than the rest of the world. And also just being like, but you're wrong.
Right.
Like, what was insane was, it's like, I know you're all wrong. So, you know, you can take away my privacy and you can take away my bodily autonomy and you can take away my freedom. And what's left? Well, what's left is me. And the thing that really stuck with me was this sense of, like, ultimately, no matter what happened, it was, my life was still my own. And I had like this idea of what my life was going to be like, and I was going to have kids and I was going to go to school and I was going to have a career and you know, all the things that we think about were going to have in life. And suddenly I was confronted with the fact that that was not going to be my life, but it still didn't mean it wasn't mine.
Yeah.
And they can't take that away from me. So I spent a lot of time in prison sort of like talking myself through what was happening to me, sort of like trying to, like, having literal conversations with a younger version of myself who didn't know what was about to happen to her, and say, here's what's going to happen. Here's why it's going to hurt. Here's how you're going to get through it, at least up to the point that I had arrived at.
Yeah.
And, you know, and every single day you just have to find your own meaning. And that, you know, being stripped of so much sort of put me into contact with ultimately what I have, what I genuinely have control over, which is so very little, but also so very much. And I think that we all would benefit from that kind of attention to what we ultimately are and can do. Anyway, I don't know if that's
that was absolutely beautifully stated, and it gets me choked up hearing you know bring that perspective. That is a powerful way to think about things, and it just shows the strength that you clearly have inside of you, and that got you through that experience that a lot of people wouldn't have survived in the way that you did and thrived through in the way you have, and in using what is just I can't even imagine more of a nightmare situation to the benefit of yourself, and now to us, to hear the perspective, to read your writing, to participate in what you're putting out there. And it's interesting because I've talked to a lot of people who have found themselves in very, very bad positions in life, sometimes through mental health, sometimes through whatever else. But generally, and this is myself included, we somehow put ourselves there, right? So I might have had, you know, a preponderance for mental health issues as a kid. My family has that, you know, but when I had my lowest point, you know, hospitalized, mental breakdown, I saw the depths of where your mind can take you. I put myself there by being on a fast track to success and entrepreneurship. I didn't need to do that. You have such a heightened perspective on this because you didn't choose to do this. You didn't choose to go through the experience that has now, you know, made you who you are. And to me, that is just such an incredible thing. And we don't hear that perspective a lot. And so the way that you just stated that with your mindset and that internal conversation that allowed you to endure and then to succeed in that way, I just think is brilliant. And I appreciate you sharing that with us.
Well, can I don't know if I'm just about to like totally and utterly disagree with you, but what I'm going to tell you is that, and maybe just food for thought.
Yeah.
Remember how I mentioned moral luck?
Yep.
There is an argument that there is a philosophical argument that all of us, all of our choices are a product less of ourselves than of the world around us, because we all exist in a world that was not of our own making. Mm. And at any given point along our journey, we made what we felt was the best choice in the moment. And one thing that I talk about when I talk about the criminal justice system that I think is really, really important is there has long been, for too long, I would say, this meritocratic narrative that says that if you're poor, if you're an addict, if you're a criminal, mm-hmm. if you're successful, if you're not successful, that's all due to your own moral success or failure. Mm. And that whatever outcome is the result is what you deserve. And I think that is a very flawed way of thinking about the root causes of people's success and failure.
Yes.
And that you being motivated to be an entrepreneur was in part a result of the world that was around you and the choices that were available to you and the opportunities of success that were put in front of you. And also the mental health problems that you went through as a result of that were because of the way that the world works and the way that the human mind works and how fulfillment and well-being is affected sure. by the worlds that we are in.
Yeah.
So I do feel bad for you. Like, I'm allowed to feel bad for you because we also, like, even people who quote unquote succeed and then struggle emotionally because of it, like, that's not your fault. Like, you're not broken or wrong to be struggling with emotional health in the face of success, because I can't even imagine how horrible it would feel to feel like not only are you miserable, but you're miserable by your own choices.
Right.
And whether that be choices that led you to success or choices that led you to do a horrific crime that then landed you in prison for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Like, that is all a factor of the world we live in and how it's not really built entirely for complete human, like, fulfilling all human potential and well-being.
Yeah. Well, listen, first of all, I appreciate that perspective. And it's so funny because this is what I say to my guests, right? When they say to me, well, don't feel bad for me, I deliver your speech. But to myself, I'm like, don't, you know, so it's funny how we have that kind of inner outer, you know, perspective, because, you know, to me, it feels like I did this. And I actually write these words in my book, like, I did this, I own this, I put myself here, I created this, so I should be, you know, paying the price for what I am. But when I hear somebody tell me that, I deliver what you just said. And so it's so funny, just the difference in our perspectives, because we can somehow, you know, not get out of our own way and our own thinking. And sometimes that self, self-victimization or something like that, where we somehow feel, or at least I felt I deserved what I was going through because of these extreme choices I was trying to make and to this bizarre notion of success that I had created and the price I paid to try to get there.
Yeah.
So with that, you know, I'm so thankful for this conversation, and I'll reach out to our mutual friend, Carrie, and tell him thanks for the intro, and we'll go from there.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
All right, Amanda. Thanks. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye. A special thanks once again to Amanda Knox for being on the show today and for opening up about the hardships of her life and the vision she sees for the future of criminal justice reform. That conversation had a big impact on me personally, and I had a couple of key takeaways. I was really happy Amanda talked about mental health so much, because especially in times like 2020, when we are naturally prioritizing our physical health because of a deadly virus and lockdown, we tend to consider our mental health as an afterthought in stressful situations, which is completely counterintuitive to overcoming those situations. We can't be at our best, solve big problems, or ultimately find success when we are really struggling mentally. So we have to make that as high of a priority as anything else we work on personally. And secondly, seeing the humanity in others. I am so unbelievably inspired by Amanda's ability to forgive and to see the good in people who sought to destroy her liberties, her youth, her entire life. I honestly don't know if I could do that. How can one be so immensely wronged by their society, yet still find opportunities to grow and to see the good in others? For me, when I hear somebody speak about that kind of growth, it makes me want to try harder in my own life to forgive and to find balance even amongst those that have wronged me. If we as a society can expand our perspectives to include things outside of our little echo chambers, maybe we can start to better see the humanity in other people. Maybe then we can learn to be less quick to judge and create a more fair society for everyone. My memoir, A Practical Way to Get Rich and Die Trying, is now available at all online booksellers and in person at Barnes & Noble. A big thanks to my partners at Jam Street Media and the producers, Maddie Stout, Amanda Rosenberg, and Casey Franco. We'll see you next Tuesday. Be safe.